He's been hiding at Yonsei University in Seoul for 2 years. He says there are 10 students currently seeking shelter at the school.
We were taught to turn off the lights and cover all windows. Don't let the North Korean enemies see us.
If there is no evidence there, and the president has said we need to produce evidence, this opens the question as to whether evidence would be planted. It would be a relatively simple thing to do.
The mafia there, the thugs roaming the streets, have more powerful guns. And he said, I'm starting to wonder, are they protected by somebody within the administration?
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, July 31st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. West African leaders have committed to deploy the first peace troops to warring Liberia by the start of next week, as Liberian President Charles Taylor vows to go into exile 3 days later. The leaders meeting in Ghana agreed to send a vanguard of 1,500 peacekeepers, expected to be two battalions from Nigeria. Ghana, Mali, Benin, Senegal, and Togo also have promised 3,250 soldiers for an eventual 5,000-strong force. The pledge came as pressure grew on regional leaders to speed a peace force promise since rebels opened 2 months of bloody siege on Liberia's capital in early June. Saddam Hussein's two daughters have arrived in Jordan from Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates with their 9 children and are, according to the Associated Press, there on the orders of King Abdullah II. They are Arab women who have run out of options, said the king. Al-Sharif, a spokesperson for the king, refused to say where in Jordan the two women were, and no other details were immediately available. The daughters had been estranged from Saddam Hussein for some time, but were believed to have reconciled with their father in recent years. Both of their husbands were killed by Saddam Hussein's sons after one of them gave information to the U.S. government about Iraq's weapons program. Yesterday, President Bush took responsibility for the unfounded claim in his State of the Union address that there was evidence Saddam Hussein was trying to purchase uranium from Niger. In response to a reporter's question, President Bush said, "I take personal responsibility for everything I say." Bush's statement follows 3 weeks of allowing other cabinet members to take the blame for the line in his address, including CIA Director George Tenet, whose department called the information into question long ago. Ray McGovern is a spokesperson for a group of retired U.S. intelligence officers called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. He's unmoved by the president's statement.
Well, I don't think there's anything else a president can say. After all, he did speak those words. I think that the inordinate emphasis on the State of the Union address can obscure the real meaning of what happened. We talk about 16 words, and certainly they didn't belong in the speech, since so many people knew those words to be spurious. But those same words, and many more than 16, those same words, that same case, that same spurious case, was used during the entire month of September and early October to persuade our representatives and our senators to authorize the president to wage an unprovoked war. This is the central problem. And never before in my 40 years in this town have I run into a situation where one branch of the government has so deliberately deceived another into ceding that part of the government's constitutional power to wage war. And that's what happened here. So in a sense, it's a red herring to focus in on what the president said in the State of the Union address. That material had already been used to very sinister purpose back the previous fall. The president answered very few questions, and each question that was put to him, he had a little canned response, whether it related to the question or not. Very, very little was learned from that press conference.
There are some polls that seem to indicate that more and more of the public now is willing to say that the president misled the American people about Saddam Hussein's weapons program. Which is interesting. And speaking of the weapons program, the president seemed to be quite confident that the U.S. is going to find weapons of mass destruction even months after the end of the war.
Yes, I've counted up the days now. It's 134 days since the invasion of Iraq. 4 months and 12 days, I think it adds up to. No sign of weapons of mass destruction whatsoever. The president insisting yesterday that he's confident that we will find some. He also said something very interesting, and that was that he acknowledges that, quote, we need to produce evidence. Now, that scares me a little.
Produce evidence.
Yeah. You know, it may have been a rhetorical slip, but if there is no evidence there, as almost everybody agrees now, if, in other words, the estimates that were adduced to persuade Congress to vote for war, if they were hopelessly off the mark, which, as I say, seems very, very likely at this point, then how is he going to produce this evidence? How is Tony Blair going to produce this evidence? And one need not be paranoid to suggest that there will be a terrific temptation to plant such evidence. And this sounds like a pretty far out charge, and it is, and I'm ashamed in a sense to even raise the issue. But if there is no evidence there, and the president has said we need to produce evidence, this opens the question as to whether evidence would be planted. It would be a relatively simple thing to do, plant a few vials of that anthrax of the kind that Colin Powell held up so demonstrably at the UN on the 5th of February.
But clearly it would be difficult to try and plant the kind of evidence that they said existed. I mean, they said more than a few vials were there. They led us to believe that they had satellite photographs of, tons or just gallons and gallons of this material, chemical and biological weapons.
They certainly did. And, of course, Colin Powell had chapter and verse there at the UN. Certainly that kind of thing will not be found. And what is completely certain is that nothing will be found that will in any way justify the president's assertions going into the war that Iraq posed a, quote, grave danger, end quote, to the national security of the United States. What I'm talking about is sort of a face-saving sort of thing which would be able to persuade some of the Americans who are really very much inclined to believe what the president said. If they discovered a few of these vials after they had been planted in the western desert of Iraq, the president could claim, and his spokesman could say, well, here they were, and these could take out whole cities. They could take Minneapolis and New York and Washington and so forth. And if people were dubious or incredulous, then he would simply say, or spin doctors would say, well, look, now, this is what we're telling you. Are you going to believe the French, those perfidious French, or the Iraqis? Who are you going to believe? You can believe your government or these other folks. What we're telling you is we found this, and so trust us.
And a good many Americans will be appalled that you're even suggesting that the U.S. would go so far as to do something like that, plant evidence.
Yes, they would be, but I could point to a study that we veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity did 2 months ago, which adduced about 6 or 7 examples of our government planting weapons, planting other evidence in various parts of the world for this kind of purpose. So if the administration decides to go this route, it's not as though the people who know how to do these kinds of things will be starting from scratch.
So now you are a retired intelligence veteran. So you're speaking from a very informed and unique perspective. You're saying, Ray McGovern, that it's highly likely that the U.S. would go so far as to plant evidence to support the administration's claim that Saddam Hussein did, in fact, have weapons of mass destruction or chemical or biological weapons of mass destruction?
No, I wouldn't say it's highly likely. I have been saying that it's a 50-50 chance. I should hasten to add that most of my colleagues in veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity are much more cautious and try to restrain me in my view on this. So my view is not a consensus view of our movement. If I heard myself saying this 5 months ago, I would have said, Ray, you've gone off the deep end. However, watching how things have evolved with the deliberate use of material known to spring from a forgery, material that was false on its face because the government of Niger had no capability of giving uranium to Iraq. All the uranium that's mined in Niger is controlled by an international consortium run by the French. So it was false on its face, and then it turned out to be based on a forgery to boot. Yul Brynner and the King and I would say, "That's a false lie." You know, so you had a double whammy here, and yet it was still used deliberately without Congress last fall. You'll notice that the president is no longer talking about weapons of mass destruction. We're talking about weapons programs, okay?
Mm-hmm. Slight little change, but very significant.
Yeah, apparently so. Mm-hmm. Now, if we went to war because Iraq had a weapons program, God help the rest of the countries of the world that have weapons programs like this. I thought the justification was because they had the actual weapon.
The Iraqi scientists are saying that, you know, there's no evidence of a weapons program. Mm. Specifically that word again, program.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one of the supreme ironies here. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and Colin Powell and others have been very, very insistent that what we needed to do was get some of these scientists and interrogate them, and then we would be led to the weapons of mass destruction. We have pretty much all of them now, and they're all singing the same song, and it's that we had weapons of mass destruction, but they were all destroyed. How? By the UN inspections and also by we ourselves. Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, Hussein Kamel, who defected in 1995, defected to us, was in charge of the missile, biological, chemical, and nuclear programs. And he told us that those that were left after he defected were destroyed at his command. And, of course, he had that right to come in. Now, do we take that at face value? Of course not. Iraqis lie just like everyone else. But what seems to be evolving now is that he was telling the truth. He also said that we'd keep the blueprints, you know, and just to keep some things so that we could reconstitute it at a later date, and that was part of his order. You may recall 3 weeks ago, a leading Iraqi scientist, actually he's the engineer in charge of the centrifuge, the nuclear centrifuge program, led people into his backyard and dug under a rose bush and came up with some blueprints and some little parts for a centrifuge. And the Western press played that up, but that wasn't the story. The story was this. When he was asked, as he was by the Western press, when did you bury these things? He said, I buried them in 1991. Who ordered you? Well, the order came from the top. And what did they tell you? Why should you bury these things? Well, we were to bury them until the order came that we were going to reconstitute this program. Did the order come? No. Now, that's horse's mouth. This is the man in charge of the program, and so for Vice President Cheney to talk, as he did starting last August, about he having information that Iraq had reconstituted its nuclear weapons development program. Here is the person in charge of that saying, well, we buried some parts and we buried some blueprints and we had the know-how, but we never got the order, never since 91, to reconstitute this program.
Ray McGovern is a spokesman for a group of retired U.S. intelligence officers called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. The majority of the respondents to an ABC News affiliate poll believe President Bush knowingly misled the American people about Iraq's program, his weapons program. 76% say yes, he did. 20% say I don't know if he did. And 4% say he didn't knowingly mislead the public. Crispin Sartwell is a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of the forthcoming book Extreme Virtue, Leadership and Truth in Five Great American Lives. In this Peace Watch commentary, he explores how the administration's lies hurt democracy and cost soldiers' lives.
In England, the question of how Tony Blair justified war threatens to bring down his government. Blair not only purveyed the sketchy rumor of uranium shipments from Niger to Saddam, supported by crudely forged documents, but flatly asserted that Saddam could launch weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes, a false claim for which there was no reasonable evidence. The death, apparently by suicide, of a scientist who told the BBC that the information was sexed up in order to lead England into war, has brought the matter to a crisis. Here in the U.S., things have not reached quite that pitch. in part because the Bush administration used Blair as its point man in making the case for war. But the matter is of the utmost seriousness, and as the information emerges, resignation or impeachment should not be out of the question. By the time Bill Clinton faced an impeachment trial, it was obvious that he had the sexual mores of a tomcat and had lied about it, but he should never have been impeached. His actions were disgusting, but they were not fundamental attacks on democracy or the legitimacy of the American state. If, on the other hand, it turns out that Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, and Powell started us killing Iraqis and Iraqis killing us by a systematic distortion of intelligence, they have instituted a government by lies, and many, many people have paid with their lives. That is an abrogation of democracy, a fundamental violation of their responsibility to the people of this nation. It seems to me that roughly what happened was this. The Bush administration decided, perhaps according to published reports, on September 11, 2001, that they would invade Iraq. The connection of Iraq to the terrorist attacks was sketchy at best. The terrorists were Arabs, and so was Saddam. But Saddam was a symbol of the failings of the first Bush administration, and precisely because he didn't present a serious chemical, biological, or nuclear threat by that point, a military victory would be relatively easy and would renew a humiliated nation's pride. If you don't think Saddam's weakness and ethnicity were factors, consider how different is our response to North Korea, with regard to which there is actual and not fictional evidence of nuclear activity, along with massive human rights violations. We're handling that matter with extreme delicacy. The Bush administration then resolved to repeat every rumor, no matter how baldly ridiculous, that justified the attack, and to repress all information that made the other way. They pressured everyone, intelligence agencies, weapons inspectors, Iraqi dissidents, to exaggerate the threat. The build-up to the war involved military maneuvering, but above all, it involved a long, drawn-out disinformation campaign designed to secure allies and public opinion. It is not the war itself that is proving to be the domestic crisis, but the disinformation that brought us to it, and that's the right result. If you can control what people believe, you can control what they do. The Bush administration managed to manufacture a consensus for war by distorting the context of public opinion so that the American people did not precisely understand what they were being asked to kill and die for. That has happened before, as when the Johnson administration manufactured an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin to justify greater war powers in Vietnam, and then prosecuted that conflict in a poisonous atmosphere of lies. That war ended Johnson's presidency. Lying about matters of state to manipulate the citizenry makes democracy impossible. You don't know what you're voting for or against. If the matter is war, lying is murder. By comparison, oral sex in the Oval Office appears downright wholesome.
Crispin Sartwell is a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Two American soldiers were reportedly killed today as troops pressed the hunt for the ousted dictator Saddam Hussein in northern Iraq. So far, 166 American forces have been killed in the Iraq War, 19 more than in the 1991 Gulf War, according to the Associated Press. Most often, our knowledge and notions of Iraq and Iraqi society are filtered through the lens of the American media. Mohammed Owais, an American of Palestinian origin, a businessman and activist, just returned from Iraq. Owais stopped by our studios today and shared his firsthand experiences of what Iraq is like after the shock and awe campaign of the Bush administration.
First, we drove 5 hours to the Jordanian-Iraqi border, and it was like hell at the Jordanian crossing point. Mm-hmm. What a humiliation. The Jordanians were not very nice to the people who are crossing over into Iraq. The humiliation the Iraqis are suffering on the hands of the Jordanian police here was the first eye-opener. I mean, this is going to get me in trouble with the Jordanians maybe, but I'm going to speak the truth. Mm-hmm. It was really an unpleasant experience. And then we crossed into Iraq, mm-hmm. and the first thing I saw was two American soldiers sitting on a barrel. Mm-hmm. I mean, they look weather-beaten, desert-beaten, heat-beaten. And we stopped there, and the guy said, "What do you want?" Even I thought it was the authority there. And mm-hmm. they said, "We're going to Baghdad." He said, "Go." So we went, and further we saw two Iraqis, who asked, "Where are you going?" I said, "To Iraq." He said, "Passport." I gave him the passport. He looked at it, stamped it. He didn't ask me what I was going to do there, whatever. But they were protected by the Americans. And from there on, that's where the disaster starts. A filling station, we needed gas. A filling station didn't have gas, but there were 15, 20 cars carrying some cans, jerry cans, in their trunks, selling gas in front of the filling station, but the filling station does not have gas. Mm. And from there on, driving about 500 kilometers through the Iraqi desert, it was a disaster. I did not see one single utility pole or the high power lines mm-hmm. standing. They were pulled down. They were broken down, pulled down, and they were cut into pieces. They took the wires and sold them. This is secondhand information. They were sold to the Turks in the north and to the Jordanians to be processed into copper and resold on the market. There is not a single pole standing anywhere from the Jordanian border all the way to Ramadi, which is 100 kilometers west of Baghdad. There is not a single pole standing. But what I saw, there is a fear on the streets of Iraq. There is fear on the face of the American soldiers who are sitting on a Humvee, one of them sitting up with a machine gun in 125 degrees, not knowing who the enemy is. Mm-hmm. And instead of us going there, I believe after what I saw, what Saddam Hussein did to Iraq, I believe Saddam Hussein had to go, but not this way. Mm-hmm. I believe that the Iraqi people need help. And I think it is our moral responsibility now to help the Iraqi people and at the same time to help our American soldiers, our sons, our daughters. I've seen a lot. I've seen soldiers, I've seen Iraqis, I've seen a dead American soldier right in front of us. An attack on the American soldiers happened. And that's what really woke me up, what are we doing here?
Did you have a chance to actually talk with any of the American soldiers while you were there?
And that is one of the greatest things that I ever did. It was talking to the American soldiers, to some of them. They keep a distance with the people. I mean, really, these poor guys in 125 degrees, they don't know who's the enemy. They don't know what they are doing there. And one of them told me, he said, let them tell me which airport, and I'm not going to use the words he used, which airport they want me to get out from, and I'll walk there across this desert. He said, I don't know what I'm doing here.
You seem to have a lot of compassion for the American soldiers as an American with a Middle Eastern heritage.
I really do have great compassion to these people. It brought tears to my eyes when I saw the American soldier being put in a body bag. You don't know who his mother is, or his sister, or his son, or his wife, but he's dead. What kills me when I watch American televisions, they start with how rosy the situation in Iraq is. They don't say that somebody got killed and he have 9 children here or 9 brothers and sisters and he belongs to this country. As if the result is what they want, mm-hmm. And I think our boys are stuck there. We need to do something for these guys. We have a moral responsibility to protect Iraq and the Iraqis. We wrecked a regime who wrecked Iraq, mm-hmm. but we shouldn't wreck the rest of Iraq and the rest of the Iraqi people. And we should not also leave our boys there sitting, not knowing who the enemy is. We are creating enemies for our boys there. And instead of being welcomed as liberators, we went to the United Nations and said, we want you to confirm that we are occupiers now. This should not happen. I am one of the newcomers to this country, 30 years only. Mm-hmm. But to me, America is my family. Mm-hmm. It could be your brother, anybody's brother, anybody's sister who is serving there, anybody's son. I have mm-hmm. a son. He can be serving there. Mm-hmm. So that's, the conviction that is down deep inside of me. We need to make this work very quickly, not to confront people and let the thugs in Iraq and some of the mafia that lived outside Iraq to come back in and practice the same practices that Saddam Hussein practiced on his people. These people had enough of wars from 1981 against Iran, against Kuwait, with the Americans, against the Americans, against everybody and his cousin. They had enough loss. Mm. I think we need to work also with the tradition. I saw some of our soldiers are not sensitive. They pulled an Iraqi guy out of a car, and they were beating him up. And you know what?
The American soldiers?
Yeah, the American soldiers. And they were jumping from their cars, and they were beating the hell out of him. I don't know what he did, but still. I did not really feel anger inside. I felt sorry for the American soldiers and the Iraqi guy. And, you know, that brought to mind during the war when there was a picture on television, a guy dragging an Arabian horse. He was in a Toyota and holding the horse in his hand. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, the poor horse doesn't know what is going to happen to him, and the guy pulling him doesn't know what to do with him. Mm-hmm. And the situation there, the American soldiers didn't know how to act, and the Iraqi guy didn't know how to act with them to protect himself from being beaten. There are traditions there, that like the headdress for an Iraqi mm-hmm. is his dignity. You cannot touch it. If it falls, I don't care how many guns you have to his head, he's going to move his hands and reach down to it and put it back on his head. Mm-hmm. We need to be sensitive to these people. But I'm not blaming the American soldiers here. I'm blaming the people who sent the American soldiers there to train them, to send the new troops. These are battle-hardened troops who went there and they were told, you know, your shortest way to your home in America is through Baghdad. They get to Baghdad and then they are telling them, you are a sitting duck. We need to advocate for the rights of the American soldiers. Mm. These poor guys need relief. They need to know that they are loved. They need to know they're not forgotten. We need to do something for them to bring them home. We need the administration to send some real good men to manage the situation there, not people with agendas and mafia.
I can't help being struck by how you seem to have a great deal of compassion for the American soldiers. And I'm not sure I'm hearing the same for the Iraqi people. And this is quite, I think, eye-opening for those of us in the peace movement to hear this.
The Iraqi people have no choice but to be there. It's their country. The American soldiers have a choice to come home to their families and their kids. They have a choice to be friends with the Iraqi people. They can be trained. The decision must come from the Pentagon and the people who are sending these guys into the killing fields of Iraq. That's why, no, I feel much big feelings for the Iraqi people. I admire these people who suffered throughout history, not just now, throughout history. Mm-hmm. And it's time for these people to really rise up and rule themselves. And I'm not saying this, get the American boys home to give a chance for one party or another in Iraq. It's time for the Iraqi people to do it. If we can help them, let's do it, but let's not make enemies out of them. Let's work with them in order for them to look at our boys here as friends, not as enemy.
Mm. Mohammed Owais, did you have a chance to speak with any of the Iraqi people? We don't hear their voices and their stories as much as we'd like to. Did you talk to any of them about how they feel about the fact that the United States is now basically occupying their country, but also about the fact that Saddam Hussein's regime has been ousted?
Yes, I did. In fact, I spent 4 nights at houses, Iraqi houses. Mm-hmm. I slept on the floor with them in the 125 degrees. And I wanted to feel, you know, what the people are feeling. And they are very happy. And I may alienate now some of my friends before I left to Iraq now. Mm-hmm. No, they are very happy Saddam is not there anymore. And they are happy he's not there, but they are not happy they are under occupation. And they are saying, you know, I mean, we'll give the Americans time, you know, to clean up and move on. If not, we're going to have to resort to arms to get them out. So I interacted with them. I spoke to the little kids. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see what the level. The little kids have anger. You know, they thought liberation is going to be, we get out from under Saddam, and that's it, we are free. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, they're not even free to go out on the street because there are so many roadblocks. There are so many restrictions. In the evening, you know, shots are being fired all night. They are afraid their father is going to be picked up and mm-hmm. this and that. So they are confused about the situation, and they are telling, they told me, they said, we'll carry arms if we have to. You know, there is danger for everybody there. I mean, I went to a restaurant. The guy told me, he said, 3 days ago, he said, we were sitting here, you know, cooking and whatever, and somebody walks in with a machine gun, robbed me and everybody who's sitting in the restaurant. That was the guy told me. And he told me, he showed me a gun, you know, that he has behind the counter. But he said, even I refuse to use it because the mafia there, the thugs who are roaming the streets, have more powerful guns. And he said, I'm starting to wonder, are they protected by somebody within the administration? And, you know, we have to be careful. We cannot continue on that route, or otherwise, instead of liberators, which I'm starting to doubt, you know, are we liberators or occupiers?
So are the U.S. troops trying to stop any of those type of situations, or is this mafia just allowed to reign?
You see, the mafia is allowed to reign.
What about the police that were supposed to be? There is no police.
I mean,
I thought they were training former soldiers to be police.
I mean, a young kid looks more powerful than some of the policemen I saw there on the street who was standing there directing traffic from afar even. The mafia is operating on the side streets in Baghdad, away from the central Baghdad area, which they call the green zone, two, three streets over from the green zone, which is not very far from the American forces. Mm-hmm. They are armed Iraqis. They are armed thugs in the area. In fact, the driver who was driving me to Basra after I finished in Baghdad offered me a gun to buy. And I said, what in the hell for? And I said, I don't need a gun. I said, I want to see what's going on. He said, yeah, but, you know, I got this, you know, it was a gold gun, gold-plated handgun.
Was it expensive?
He started with $2,000, and I wanted to see. I was haggling with him, and I didn't want to buy a gun. He went down to $200 just to get rid of it. But there are so many guns on the street. You know, the side streets are still very dangerous. You know, if the danger is that close to the Americans, I'm afraid, you know, one spark may cost everybody a lot of lives, Iraqis and Americans.
Mohammed Owais, an American of Palestinian origin, a businessman and an activist who just returned from the Middle East. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.